So my name's Alana. I'm a grateful recovered compulsive overeater. And I'm so grateful to be just to have this opportunity to share with you today. I just want to pray first. So let's all say the wee version of the Serenity Prayer after a moment of silence for the still suffering compulsive overeater inside and outside the rooms. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okay, so I also just want to add this. I want to ask God to have me say what he wants me to say and to have each of you hear what he needs you to hear today. So I don't speak for all of OA. What I have to share with you today is my experience, strength, and hope. So take what is helpful to you and leave the rest. To qualify, I've been in OA for 16 years. My first OA meeting was August 19th, 2007. And my abstinence date is October 2nd, 2007. So I've been abstinent for 16 years. Thank you for celebrating my birthday month with me. And I've been released 35 to 40 pounds of excess weight from my top weight. And that's the power of God. So I'm going to talk about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. So over the past 16 years, my OA fellows have seen me through a lot. Breakups, job losses, changing careers, the death of my best friend, and estrangement from family members. Hang on, I can't read what I've written. Getting older. Ah, so much better. It doesn't make me nauseous to put these on. It's actually really helpful. So I'm so happy to be here today, together again, in person, sharing my story with you. So I believe that I've been a compulsive overeater my whole life. My favorite books when I was a little girl, and this is not OA-approved literature, Moira's Birthday by Robert Munsch. She got 200 pizzas and 200 birthday cakes for her birthday, and I thought that was the best birthday present a girl could ever ask for. And Each Peach, Pear, Plum. And it was about all these fairy tale characters that came together to eat this big pie. Like, the pie was like the main character of the story. Garfield's Picnic Adventure. At one point, they open up the picnic basket, and Garfield's inside, and he's eaten all of the picnic. Those are the kind of books that struck my fancy when I was a little girl. Like, it was always about the food. Holidays were always about what food was served. That was kind of the main event for me. And just even way back in the crib days, when I was weaned off of my soother, I went into withdrawal. I curled up in the corner of my crib and said, "Sus, sus, sus," and my parents took me to the hospital because they thought that I had swallowed a pin or something. They didn't know what was wrong with me, but I was in withdrawal. I had this oral fixation from a very, very early age. Today, being a compulsive reader is one of the best things about me, which I'm so, so grateful for. But of course, I didn't think that at the time growing up. I was overweight since about the age of 7 or 8. It started to show up on my body at that time, and it was always a source of shame for me to be overweight. And I was successful in lots of different other areas of my life, but the weight was never something that I had insight in how to manage. And I was put on my first diet at the age of 10, and I was really good for 4 days, and then I would go off. And that was kind of a template for every other subsequent diet that I would ever do. Really good for 4 days, and then I couldn't sustain that, as I'm sure many of you can relate to. I know I've heard a lot of stories of people that have lost lots of weight and kept it off for years. I never had that kind of willpower. And the thing about diets that I could just never stand was the feeling of deprivation. Like, I just could not handle that. Like, I just needed to have my drug. My relationship with exercise was similarly contentious. I couldn't exercise for the life of me. I couldn't commit to that. And in my teenage years, like late childhood, teenage years, my sister, who I always compared myself to, she was always thin, and I was always jealous of that. She had these workout videos, and she had no problem sticking to exercise. Like, she enjoyed it, and I did not understand that. Why? How could you possibly enjoy exercise? Like, it's hard. You get sweaty, and you get hot, and it's gross, and I just hated it. But I forced myself to do it. But again, I couldn't stick to the workout videos for longer than 4 days. I had this every inclination to get up every morning and do it, but I just couldn't stick to it. And we had this hill in Calgary, where I'm from. There's this big hill called Nose Hill, and my sister and my mom would hike up Nose Hill every day. And I tried to follow in their footsteps, and when I would hike up Nose Hill, I would always have to stop midway through and catch my breath. I could never make it all the way to the top. I had a lot of shame about that as well. And I just didn't understand how certain people had control and power around the food. Certain people could be thin, certain people could exercise, and I just didn't have that power. And some of the crazy things that I did with food, when I was in grade 6, we had to sell chocolate-covered almonds as part of a fundraiser. And so we were sent home with a case of these boxes of chocolate-covered almonds, and I just worked my way through that case, box by box, and then had to pay for the proceeds of the entire case with my allowance. So, huge source of shame for me. That is one of those foods that I cannot start without. I can't stop once I start, which I'm sure a lot of you guys can relate to. So, when I was leaving elementary school, like, I was a very gregarious, very confident, very smart kid. And my dad was nervous because he's like, you know what? He's like, I think you need to lose weight before you go into junior high school. And he had every good intention because he knew, I didn't know this, but he knew how cruel people could be in junior high school. I didn't know. And then I did. So started junior high school, hadn't lost any weight, and I was horribly and relentlessly bullied. I could really relate. I could relate to what our keynote last night shared, just about feeling alienated and just kept on the outside. And because I was smart, I think that made it worse, because boys especially like identified this weak spot that was visible to everybody, that I was overweight, and they just picked at it every single day. I was systematically just abused, and it just took a huge toll on my self-esteem. And I would come home every day after school, and I would cry. And my mom would hold me, and she would cry with me. But she didn't know what to do. What do you do? What do you do when you're vulnerable like that? Like, there really is nothing to do. I didn't have any skills for how to protect myself from that. So super painful. However, I did have food. Food was one of those things that gave me comfort, and it was a friend to me. I felt very friendless in junior high school, but food was a friend to me. And I would eat in secret. That's another big part of my story, is coming home and my mom wasn't home, she was working, and I would melt cheese on something, anything, and eat that, and then eat at regular dinner she was none the wiser. And we never really talked about my weight. We never really talked about, well, what are you eating, and why is there a weight problem? Like, I don't remember that being a thing. Kind of a little bit of a backstory. There was lots of addiction in secret in my home. My dad was drinking in the closet, and he came out of the closet when I was 13. My brother was a closet drug user. So there's so much secrecy in our family. I'm happy to report today that every single member of my family is in recovery. So I have, yeah, it's worth celebrating. So that's really cool, and something I'm super grateful for. Another crazy thing that I did with food, the Halloween candy was always gone by Remembrance Day. And for those of you who don't know when Remembrance Day is, in Canada we celebrate Remembrance Day on November 11th. So all of the Halloween candy, at least all the good stuff, was gone by November 11th. And I never understood those kids that still had Halloween candy around at Easter time. Like, what are you doing with your time? Like, seriously, like, why is that not a priority for you? It was for me. So in childhood, adolescence, my weight was a huge source of frustration and shame for me. And it says in step one in the OA 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, we thought if only we could get to the perfect weight, life would be wonderful. And I thought that. So, but every night before bed, I would pray to wake up thin in the morning. And that didn't happen. And on some level, I understood that it wouldn't work out that way, but that something more was required than that, but I had no clue what that something was. And it says also in step two in the OA 12 and 12, it says, our prayers for help might have gone unanswered because we were never meant to face this disease in isolation. I did face this disease in isolation. Nobody else around me knew what I was going through. And I'd imagine a lot of you face this disease in isolation. I was never meant to recover from this disease in isolation, which is why I need all of you. So it was only when I was finally willing to admit that I couldn't do this alone, that I was willing to admit that my strategies had failed utterly, and that I was willing to ask others how they did it, listen to them, and then do what they said had worked for them, both parts of that prayer were answered for me. So I woke up and I got thin. Both of those things happened when I started in OA. So, you know, those little childish petitions, like, there's more wisdom to that than you might think, you know? Like, I think it's okay to pray to wake up thin. You just never know how your prayer is going to be answered. And I'm just so grateful that prayer has been answered for me. So some of the shameful thoughts that I lived with constantly that were a product of my disease was in internalizing the messages that I got in junior high school. So the main message that I think I internalized was that there was lots of sexual harassment too. Like, there was just no boundaries whatsoever in junior high school. The main message I got was that women are only good for one thing, and because you're fat, you're not good for that one thing. So my sense of self-worth was just in the toilet when I left junior high school. So went into junior high school, gregarious, confident, just myself. And leaving junior high school, I was very withdrawn, very shy, very timid. And one sec. Remember this one time when I was on the bus. This was just after junior high school, and this boy said hello to me on the bus, and I couldn't say hello back. I couldn't get the words out because I was just so scared and, like, so ashamed of myself. I just couldn't be seen. So in high school, I made more of a conscious effort to make friends. Like, I was living kind of a more balanced life. In junior high school, it was all about the studies. Like, I was the top student all the way through junior high school. High school, I made more of an effort to make friends. However, the compulsive overeating still continued. Nothing ever changed in that department. So my self-esteem improved a little bit because I now had a group of friends, but continued on in university. And in university, I gained the freshman 15. And I didn't understand when my classmates talked about being stressed out. So looking back, I realized that I had always pre-medicated my stress with food. So when other folks were stressing out and feeling their feelings, I was eating. And I had always learned how to do that. You know, like, food was so effective for me. It was effective for me as a comfort, as a friend, times of celebration, times of grief, times of stress, school stress. It was a very effective tool. And I'm grateful today that I had it, because I didn't have any other tools, as I'm sure many of you can relate to. So fast forward to the very last year of university. It was kind of a perfect storm. I had just broken up with a boyfriend. I was on a diet. I was training for a half marathon, and I was house-sitting for my brother. So it was the first time that I had a fridge and a pantry all to myself. And you know what it says in the OA 12 and 12 about how each period of control was followed by a period of uncontrolled eating. And that was very much my experience on this diet. So, again, I'd be really, really good for 4 days, and then I would be binging. And that cycle was just continuing. I was just eating everything that I could to just fill that hole. And I'm really grateful for the hole that the diet kind of really exposed in me, because it got me to see how insane my behavior was. And I really hadn't seen that it was insane up until that point. Like, I thought that what I did with food was normal. I thought the way that I thought about food was normal. So I was standing on the scale, willing the number to be lower, and it wouldn't go any lower. And I was totally demoralized. And one little anecdote about that time, I got new orthotics in my running shoes. And the podiatrist said, you know, don't go crazy the first time that you wear these. Maybe a kilometer or two. So that's like maximum a mile. And because I was working hard to work the points off that I'd gone over the day before, I went for a 12-kilometer run, which is about 7.5 miles. And I wore holes the size of golf balls in the arches of my feet from these orthotics that were rubbing on my feet. And I remember laying in bed that night, feet throbbing, couldn't sleep. And then the answer came to me. Ice cream. So driving to 7-Eleven, middle of the night, to get my medicine, because that was my solution. That was my solution for any kind of pain, physical, emotional. So that summer, that was a low point for me. I felt so lonely. I didn't think anybody understood. But because I had family in recovery at that time, I knew that something like OA must exist, or something for people with my issues with food, it must exist. So I found OA online, and I went to my very first meeting on August 19th, 2007. And at that meeting, I knew I was home right away. I was not one of those folks that questioned, am I a compulsive overeater? Do I belong here? I want to dabble? No, there was none of that. There was, you are my people. Because at this meeting, there was folks that talked about food the way that I thought about it. They did stuff with food that I did with food, but they were abstinent, they were happy, and they were, a lot of them were thin. That from what I recollect, I remember exactly where that meeting was. There's actually somebody here in the room today that was at that first meeting. And there was a woman there who, she was sitting across from me, and she opened up her mouth, and my story came pouring out of her mouth, and I wanted her to be my sponsor. I think I found that out over a couple weeks, that this is the person I wanted to be my sponsor. And at that meeting, they talked about not eating sugar. And I was like, oh, like that's a punch to the gut. Like I can't, how could you possibly ask me to not eat sugar? Like this is my drug. Like these are my friends. Like this is what I use for comfort. So after the meeting, we were chit-chatting fellowship, and I said to one member, I was just looking for a loophole. I'm like, so when you say no sugar, do you mean no cake? She's like, that's right. I'm like, no cookies? That's right. And she said to me, if it feels like you got kicked in the stomach at the thought of having to give up a particular food, chances are that's a food you have to give up. So I tried the no sugar thing, but a month later, went on a class trip with my classmates, and I was trying to do the no sugar thing, and I found a store. So I'm from Canada. This trip was in the States. I found a store that sold sugar-free chocolate in the mall, and I bought a pound and a half, and I took it back to my room, my hotel room, and I ate it all at once. And then I went back the next day, and I tried that experiment again. And I was sitting in my hotel room, binging. One of my classmates walks in and catches me mid-binge. I stop mid-chew, and I get rid of the evidence. Demoralizing. And the girls that were on this trip with me, they were all thin. They were all eating whatever they wanted to eat, drinking whatever they wanted to drink. And I was the fat one drinking the Diet Coke. So there was something wrong with that picture. I didn't understand it. So after that binge, on the phone to my mom, crying, saying, I don't know how to stop. And she was crying too, because she didn't know. She wanted to help me, but she didn't know how to help me. And that was my bottom. I didn't know that, but that was my bottom. And I came back from that trip, and I binged one more time on dried fruit, and then something happened in me. I had this struck abstinent experience. So step one was working me. And step one started to work me long before I got into the rooms of OA. Like that whole... my whole life really has been that step one experience, like gathering enough evidence that I am powerless over this thing. And that summer was particularly spiritual for me. Didn't feel spiritual, but it was very spiritual because I was getting the last bits of evidence that I needed that I was totally powerless. And I can't fast track that. It says in the AA 12 and 12, it's not by virtue that we hit a bottom. It's by circumstance. So I might say this again later, but I just want to say it now in case you forget, is if I see other people in the rooms that are not abstinent, and I think, oh, they're not working their program right, clearly, they're not working their program the way that I think they should be doing it, if they're not absent, it's because they're not meant to be yet. And I don't dictate the pace that anybody else recovers. So I need not be self-righteous or smug about what other people are doing, because everybody is on a journey, and I needed to be on a journey. I had my own journey, and I got abstinent at precisely the moment that I was meant to get abstinent, because I got in enough pain at precisely the moment that I was supposed to be in that amount of pain. And if somebody had approached me in advance, like if an OA member had walked up to me on the street and said, you know what, you look overweight, want to come to a meeting? I'm sure that would have turned me away. So I'm just grateful for the way that it unfolded, because everything happened exactly the way that it was supposed to, I believe. So one of the things that I've learned in recovery is that the disease always lies. And at that very first meeting, when I was feeling that sinking feeling about the thought of having to give up sugar, what I've learned is that the disease convinces me that something bad will happen if I'm about to do something incredibly healthy for myself. So convincing me something terrible is going to happen if you give up chocolate. Like, that was one of the big ones for me, was chocolate. How could I go 16 years without eating chocolate, let alone a week? And the answer is, one day at a time. It's possible. One day at a time. And you know what? Nothing bad happened when I gave up sugar. Only good things happened. Lots of good things happened when I let go of those things that I was using to medicate my life. Because my feelings, the things that I'm trying to avoid, that's my life. That's a part of my life. My fear, my shame, my guilt, my sadness, all of that is a part of being a human being. But I didn't know how to tolerate that stuff. All I knew how to do was to medicate it, like pre-medicate it with food. So the Big Book talks about two different types of spiritual awakenings. So those that are sudden and those that are slow and gradual. And the waking up that I've experienced in OA has been both kinds. So my sudden awakening was how I got abstinent. So I was struck abstinent. And after that, there was still some slips. Like I would go a few days trying to be abstinent, but that abstinence where I was struck abstinent, there was no more binging and there was no more recreational sugar after that time. And I don't even know if I was working the steps at that point. I think that was like kind of a step zero experience. And then I started to work the steps with a sponsor. I asked that woman to be my sponsor. And at first she said, you know what? I'm full right now with sponsees, but I'll be your temporary sponsor. And when she said that, I heard, I don't like you very much. I just want to lose you. So yeah, fine. But then a couple weeks later, we've been working together, and she's like, you know what? One of my sponsees dropped me, so I can take you on full time. And I was like, you like me. You really like me. So that was good. And oh my gosh, what an amazing gift she was to me. She's not even in the program anymore. She went to another food addicts program because she couldn't get abstinent in this. She couldn't stay abstinent in this program, but she was there for me precisely the moment that I needed her to be. And she took her recovery so seriously, and so did I. So the way that I recovered in OA was using the OA 12 Steps and 12 Traditions and the OA 12 Steps and 12 Traditions workbook, the red one. I think there's a new edition of it since then. And the way that I would work my program was I would answer the questions furiously every week, and then we would meet once a week, and I would share my answers to the questions. And I remember my step five with her. I remember, and it was long. Like, this lady was so dedicated. I spent 25 hours doing my first step five. I am not even kidding you. Not all in one go, but over the course of installments over a couple different weekends. Perfectionist, wanted to be thorough, wanted to get this program and get an A. That's how I do everything. So I remember sitting on her bed and talking for the first time about some of the stuff that was said to me when I was in junior high school. And you know how when you're abused, you think it's your fault, and so you feel shame when you tell other people what other people did to you? It's kind of weird how that works. But when I was telling her some of the nasty things that were said to me in junior high school, I just remember tears streaming down my face. And she was just like, mm-hmm. Like, there was such just utter acceptance there. And oh, how relieving that was. Which kind of brings me to the slow and gradual awakening that I experienced. So leaving her house after that step five, I just remember looking at the world differently and seeing the sky was so blue. And the clouds were so white. It was so beautiful. My senses started to wake up in this program. So my sense of vision became clearer. My sense of smell and taste became sharper. I could hear things more clearly. Like there was a mindfulness that was kind of just coming to me. It was really cool. And I become more conscious. I think that's the best word to describe it. But I've also become more self-conscious, which can be a pain at times because I'm really acutely aware of what I say, how I say it, and how it's going to impact others. But this self-consciousness, it serves a valuable purpose for me. So it helps to alert me as to whether I'm behaving in a way that causes harm and then requires amends. Because formerly, I was just bulldozing my way through my relationships, like just so argumentative, always needed to be right, and I wasn't really conscious of how my behavior was potentially harming others. I've woken up to reality, which is often painful. And I stopped using food to avoid the pain of reality. But I've realized that I also have other ways that I've learned to run away from the pain. You know, like this disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and it shows up in all different other areas. So other ways that I avoid the pain include laying blame. Like that's a big one for me. That was a big thing in my family, like finger pointing and laying blame. Whose fault is it? If something's wrong, it's somebody's fault. And that was a big part of my childhood growing up, was trying not to be the one who was getting blamed. Thinking obsessively. That's another one. Being too busy. That's another thing that I can do. And it's a very socially acceptable way to run away from my pain because it's like, oh, I'm so busy. But it's just like, is there any time in your busy schedule to actually sit down and process your feelings? I'm learning that now, 16 years in program, that I need to actively schedule. I'm such an emotional person. I need to actively schedule time to feel my feelings, which again is kind of a pain, but it's kind of a small price to pay to just be able to be a human and not have to eat compulsively anymore. So when people said, feel my feelings, I did not understand what that meant. So what I'm currently learning in this phase of recovery, what that means is to consciously pause and turn toward the pain of my reality, to turn towards the pain and embrace it and embrace my dark side. And what I find is that on the other side of that is compassion and peace and grace and God's love. What I've learned is that I can't have compassion without having suffering. There's a reason for all of this suffering that I've had and that we've all had. But it's really only in working this program that helps to make meaning of all of that and looking back and saying, oh yeah, that had to happen that way. I had to be a compulsive overeater. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here right now sharing this incredible message of hope. Like there's miracles to be experienced. And I want everybody here, if you're new, I want you to stay until you get to experience those miracles. Please don't leave, because this program is guaranteed not to work if you're not in it. So be here. So in OA, I've also woken up to my purpose, which the page 77 of the big book, I believe every single phrase in the big book is true. On page 77, it spells it out clearly for me. It says, it's to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and to the people about me. So there are still many question marks in my spiritual journey, things that I don't understand, things that aren't clear yet. However, I'm grateful that my purpose is not one of those things. It's not one of those question marks, rather. So praying to God each morning to provide me with opportunities to be of service to my fellows is a prayer that is always answered. There's so much help that's needed out there. And God has equipped me uniquely to be of service. And he's equipped each of you uniquely to be of service, too. So if you're somebody who's sitting here, maybe you're new, maybe you're in relapse, and you're thinking, man, I'm useless. What is my purpose? I don't have any purpose. You don't know that yet. You don't know that yet. And I suggest that you look at page 77 of the big book, because that tells me what my purpose is. And I believe that each single one of us has a unique purpose. And I believe that my compulsive overeating is a big part of that. Being an addict is a big part of how I'm useful to other people. So because God wants to use me, I believe that's why he made me, is because he wants to use me. And the fruits of being of service to others, there's many, 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 many fruits of that. So one is my confidence in myself has improved. My ability to be helpful, my sense of self-esteem have all improved. So I feel like I've kind of reclaimed that gregarious, confident child that I was pre all the abuse in junior high school, before this disease really took a big hold on me. And I've learned all that. I've relearned all of that, how to be my true self in OA. And I don't do that perfectly. Like, I don't want to lie and say I'm always my true self all the time. Like, there's definitely still vestiges of the disease that are present in me, which I will get to later. So one part of living my purpose is in OA, I woke up to the fact that the career that I had chosen was unfulfilling. So when I went to university, I took a major that was like very math and science focused because that's what I was good at. But when I got into the work world, I hated it. And after about a year, I had a friend who was like same vintage as me. Like, she was a geologist, and she's like, you know what? I hate this job. She's like, I'm going back to become a teacher. I'm going back to school. And I was like, you can do that? You can change your mind? Well, that's not what was modeled for me. And so I changed careers. And you know what? It was sponsoring women in this program that made me wake up to what my true passion was. And that's the direction that I went with my career. And I kid you not, it felt like God, from the moment I decided to change careers, it felt like God was opening up doors and I was just walking through them. It was effortless. My master's was an effortless. And getting into the career itself, it's felt effortless. Like, I just feel like I have my true calling. I thank God every day in my nightly review that I send to my sponsor. I send her a list of things I'm grateful for. And one of them is that I have this job that I love and I'm excited to go to work in the morning. Like, I recognize that that's a huge blessing, because some people go their whole lives without finding out what their true passion is, what their true calling is. But in the OA 12 and 12, it talks about how intuition is meant to be God's direct line of communication into my heart. The only thing is that my compulsive overeating and my problems interfered with the connection. So because I'm abstinent in the program and I'm living by the principles, God's able to just give me direction and I'm able to just follow it. It's not always that clear. With my career, though, it was so, so clear. So grateful for that. So I want to talk about how I work step 11, because that's a really big part of my, all the steps are a big part of my daily practice, but step 11 is one of my favorites. And I've done a lot of that in the, for 16 years I've been meditating. My sponsor recommended, before we got to step 11, she said, I think you should start meditating now. And I'm really, really grateful for that. So the way that I work step 11 is I set time aside in the morning and I have a little yoga block that I sit on. I have a blanket, I have a bear, I have a candle, I have books, I have a journal. I have everything that I need, and I ask God to help me to set aside everything that I know or think I know about God, recovery, the 12 steps, me, other people, love, and relationships, so that I may have an open mind. And I ask God to show me the truth about these things. Because I'm somebody who thinks I know. Like, I'm a learner, I'm an academic, and I just love that feeling of I know. Like, I know what's going on. And I so don't know. I so don't know so much. And I feel like being here has really helped to remind me of that there's just like so much that I've learned from each of you. I loved all the sessions that I went to this weekend, and I just learned so, so much from every single one of you that I interacted with and that I heard speak. One thing that really stuck with me from the body image thing last night was, don't try to evolve past where you are. And oh my goodness, do I ever try to do that? Do I ever try to rip this flower open and blossom before it's ready? And I mean, you know, the blossom just naturally opens as I just absorb the nourishment, as the flower absorbs the sun and the water and the whatever else, air, whatever else flowers need to in order to grow. As it just absorbs that nourishment, it just blossoms naturally. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. If I have time, I think I'm running short on time. How much time do I have left? I know I...
Yeah, we've got 15 minutes to like 5 minutes.
Okay, perfect. So another 20 minutes. Awesome, thank you. Okay, so what was I talking about? I was talking about step 11. So I sit in meditation for 30 minutes. I used to listen to guided meditations, and now I just sit and just notice what's going on inside me. I notice my feelings, and then I go into them. Like, if the feeling is intense, if it's uncomfortable, instead of pushing away from it, instead of trying to talk myself out of it, instead of toxic positivity-ing myself, I'll go deep into it, and I'll let myself feel it. And sometimes that results in, like, big emotional releases. And, oh, do I ever need to do that? Because there's so much grief that this little girl and this teenager had to carry that, as I wake up in recovery, I'm still shedding that grief. You know, like, I don't think that this ever really ends. But that's a good thing. It's good to be able to feel my feelings and release that grief. And then on the other side of that, I find that peace and I find that reprieve. So I sit for 30 minutes in meditation, and then the way that I pray is, I don't believe there's any wrong way to pray, but the way that I pray is, it's called help, thanks, wow. So I ask God for help with all the things that I need help with. I say thank you for all the things that I'm thankful for. And the wow is like those moments of awe. And I get those frequently. The longer I'm in recovery, the more I see them, the more I see the miracles. And I want to share this with you. When we did the art thing yesterday, it's not quite finished. Can anybody read what that word says? That's funny. That was the first word that I was going to use, but that's not the word that I chose. It says miracles. And the reason I chose that word is just because that's kind of, I feel like that's the theme of this talk. And this is the theme of my life, really, is the miracles that I've experienced and witnessed in my life. I want to jump ahead a little bit. So one thought that kind of plagued me ever since my teenage years was that I'm going to be alone forever, that I'm not going to have a partner. Because I just felt so unworthy, I felt so unattractive, and I was told that systematically, that I'm unattractive. And I never dated when I was a teenager. And I got engaged in May. And then he broke off the engagement September 1st. Yeah. total bummer. Yeah. And the past 6 weeks have been the most painful in my entire life. And because I'm not only grieving the loss of my partner, I'm also grieving the loss of the dream that we had together, you know? And it's like, I'm not as young as I look. Like, the window for having kids is closing. Like, that's one of the things that I want. Like, I want a family. And I feel like this is kind of where the theme of together again comes in. Because together again, for me right now, means together again with my higher power. And this experience has brought me so close to my higher power. The day that he ended it, that evening we were going to be going on a week-long camping trip together. And I decided to go by myself. So being in nature, I felt shame, I felt pain, I felt sadness, I felt grief. Oh, it was just gut-wrenching. But I didn't feel lonely, because when I'm in nature, it's just like, oh, there's God. There's God. God's everywhere. And I don't need to look any further than the boundaries of my campsite to see God in absolutely everything. So it was good for me to take that time. And I did a lot of meditation and I going into the pain. And I'm not using anything to medicate. I'm not using food or any of my other compulsive behaviors. I'm in a number of different 12-step programs, just so you're aware. I call it the OA Plus program. That's not original. That's from somebody who led a retreat in Calgary a couple months ago. But there was this one night where I was meditating by the campfire, and the message or the words that were going through my head are, what is it that you really need? And I opened my eyes, and there sitting in my campsite is a fox. And he's looking right at me. And where I come from, foxes are rare to see. I don't know if they're common around here, but they're rare in Calgary and area. So he just looks at me. And then he sniffs around in the bushes and then makes a wide berth around my campsite. And then he stops and he looks at me again. And then he trots away. And when I came back and I was telling this story to some of my program friends, one of them looked at the spiritual meaning of the fox. And this is what it said. The fox encourages you to exercise discernment, trust your intuition, and maintain a keen sense of adaptability. It's an invitation to embrace change and learn to navigate transitional periods with grace and courage. Yeah. Yeah. So I share this with you because it's just a reminder that God is giving me exactly what I need in every single moment. I assure you that I've had some serious doubts about that. And one of the things that makes me doubt God is that the answer to my prayer is often accompanied by pain. And as an addict, and as a human being, I don't like pain. So when I pray for God to reveal to me the truth, it's often painful when he does. And I've come to believe that that's the reason for my dishonesty and my denial back when I was eating compulsively. So it's just a strategy. It's just a tool. It's a way for me to avoid feeling the pain that accompanies the truth. So I believe that I was the only sane person in my family. So my dad's an alcoholic, brother's a drug addict, sister and mom are both codependent. I'm the only sane person in this family. Like, what the heck? Little did I know. I was totally in denial. I had no idea that my weight was a symptom of this addiction that I had. And when I would go to my brother's birthday meetings in NA, I felt so at home. And we were giving hugs afterwards. I'm like, I wish I could have an addiction so that I could come to these meetings. And they were like, yeah. So a few years later, I find myself in OA. And I get to experience all the cool stuff that all the addicts at NA get to experience. So it says in the OA 12 and 12, we hid from the pain of our mistakes through compulsive overeating, so we didn't learn from them. We never grew up. I need to face all of my feelings and feel all the deeper stuff that I've been running away from. So the fear, the shame, the grief, the loss, and the pain if I want to mature and to grow into the person that God has designed me to be. And shame was a big, big, big companion for me over the past 6 weeks. I kicked myself for the way that I behaved in the relationship, just beating myself up for the mistakes that I made and just going over and over, and if only I hadn't said that or done that. There was lots of if-onlys and should-haves that flooded my mind. And I asked myself, how could a recovered person act that way? And one morning I was feeling particularly consumed by shame, and I did the thing. I meditated and I went deep into it. And I received the intuitive thought to write down all the things that I did right in the relationship. How I showed up, how I was loving, and just pages and pages poured out of me. Like, there is a lot. And this, and talking to my sponsor, and working step seven, like this has really been a step seven experience for me the past 6 weeks. It's helped me to recognize that shame is just yet another way that self-centeredness manifests. So thinking I'm the worst person in the world is just as much a distortion of reality as false pride is. And this is what I think it's being referred to in the big book, where it says we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, because this diminishes our usefulness to others. So if my usefulness is diminished, it's probably because I'm being self-centered in some way. And shame, it's self-centered. And that's okay. If I feel shame, that's okay. I'm a human being. I'm meant to be self-centered. That's how God made me. But the whole point of this program is trying to do what God wants me to do, even though I am self-centered still. And I believe I always will be. So shame is that message that tells me that I'm the scum of the earth, that I'm too damaged to be forgiven, that I'm too damaged to be redeemed, that I'm unworthy of love and respect. And if that isn't the voice of the disease, I don't know what is. And it's the same disease that tells me that something bad is going to happen if I give up sugar. It's the same disease that tells me that other people don't understand what I'm going through, so I shouldn't reach out, I shouldn't pick up the phone, because they're just not going to understand. And it's the same disease that tells me that I'm going to be alone forever, unworthy of love. And the disease always lies. So I think one of the reasons why it's important to be in companionship in recovery is because we need to out the disease to other people and share what we're going through. And they need to help out the disease to us too. And I had an experience with this 3 days after the breakup, so distraught. I was hardly eating. I'm a compulsive reader. I was hardly eating. I was so depressed. And I decided to do a step four. And I furiously wrote the step four. I felt like crap while I was doing it. And then I'm like, I needed to do a step five. So I get on the phone with my sponsor. She listens. And then she was very firm with me. And she said, you are using step four as a whipping post. You are not bad. You are scared. And that's okay. It's okay to be human. It's okay to have lots of fear. In the relationship, I had so much fear. So one thing she said that was really impactful for me, she's like, you know what? It's not you were so bad and he was so innocent, or the other way around. She's like, you're both innocent. You both have pain. You both have pain from your past that you carry with you. And it shows up in relationships. I'm very impressed with people that I see are married for long periods of time, because I'm just like, wow, like, you must really be working through your stuff. It's really impressive to me. So, that shame is something that only the voice of my higher power can cut through. And what I've been doing now in the 6 weeks is, when it surfaces, I'm asking God, I'm like, God, please cut through this. Like, penetrate through this, because I can't do it. I can't risk a one-on-one combat with my disease. It's too big for me, because I'm here. My disease is here. It's more powerful than I am. But my higher power, it's everywhere. It's all around here. So that's what I need to depend on. My higher power is my only hope, really. It's my only hope to cut through the shame. And it's also my only hope for getting those prayers answered. Because you know how it says in step 11, we prayed only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. I don't pray just for that. I also petition God to fulfill the desires of my heart. I also pray for other people. And I believe that God put this desire, just wrote it on my heart to have a family for a reason. It's a God-given desire, and therefore I believe that it's good. So I ask God for fulfillment of those things. And I just want to invite folks, if you have a need, like deep, deep, deep down in your heart, if you have a need, if you have a want, communicate that to your higher power and ask for it. Because when I was praying to wake up thin, like, that was just an innocent little prayer of a kid, and God was listening. Perfect. So I want to talk about together again in person. So in June, my home meeting Tuesday night has been on Zoom since 2020. And there's two of us that are like, we want to go back to face-to-face. And in June, I went to this AA roundup. And there was a speaker there that just, he moved me so much. He's so much recovery, like total rags to riches story. And he was talking about his home meeting, the primary purpose group. And he was just upselling this meeting a lot. And so I'm like, you know what, I'm going to check this meeting out. So I go to this open AA meeting, and it was astounding. It was like God was just flying everywhere. Like, there was so much recovery. There was so much joy. There was so much life in this meeting. And I went up to the chair afterwards, and I'm like, you know what, can I have your meeting format? Like, I'm in OA. I want to start a primary purpose group in OA. And their main premise is focusing on the instructions in the first 164 pages of the big book. And he's like, yeah, it's available online. So I download this meeting format. We adapted it for OA, and we started a primary purpose OA group on September 12th. So it's on Tuesday night. We're still small. There's only four regular attendees, but I'm hoping that we're going to grow. And one of the really cool characteristics about this group is that they hand out stickers for step milestones, not just sobriety milestones, but for step milestones. So for anybody who's had a new experience in the last 2 weeks with steps 1, 3, 4, 5, 9, and 12, you get a sticker. And at this meeting, when I saw, there was just one guy in particular, when he went up there to get his sticker for his new experience with step 3, maybe it was, and just the look of pride on his face, and I'm just like, whoa, like, these alcoholics, they cherish their recovery. They're hanging on to it for dear life. Like, they know how important it is. And I pray for that in OA. I want people to treat the steps like this is my life raft, you know? Because it is. And I think, I think we forget that this is a life or death disease. So I want to read something to you. Follow along if you want to. It's the step 10 promises. I have my big book here. So the reason I like this is because it describes, page 84, bottom of the page, it describes in a better way than I could, the miracle of release that I've experienced as a result of working the program in OA. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. And this has come true for me, not just with the food, but with exercise as well. So I mentioned before that exercise was something that I just really struggled with. In a way, I learned that I'm an athlete. And I do all kinds of outdoor sports, and I love it. And it's easy for me now. Like, I'm one of those people that loves exercise. I've been completely changed and rearranged. And I don't have to eat. I don't have to eat over any of the stuff that I've been experiencing, any of the grief or loss, any of the pain. You know, like, I've been through a lot, as we all have. And I don't believe any of us have to eat compulsively, but we need to find a different way. We need to find a different way of facing life squarely and sanely. And this is a design for living that works in rough going. So my prayer for all of you here today, if there's anybody here that's struggling, silently, maybe you're acting like things are okay, but things are actually not okay inside, please do yourself a service and tell somebody about it. Before you leave this room, turn to somebody else and say, you know what, this is what's actually going on for me. Exchange numbers, because the disease, it can't exist if we shine the light of awareness on it. And if we have two addicts looking at it together that are working their program, that are in recovery, the disease, it likes the dark corners. So please do me a favor, well, do yourselves a favor, and shine that light of awareness on the disease. And if there's anybody here who has not experienced this miracle of release that I just described in the first, or in the Step 10 promises, please keep coming back. And work the steps with a sponsor. That's something that I had to do when I came to this program in order to get what I've gotten. So thank you so much for asking me to speak here today, and thank you for my abstinence.